So this afternoon, if I may, I want to continue with looking at what the Buddha was saying. And of course, all these quotes come from various Pali Sutta. So it's more like the original teaching of the Buddha. So the first quote is the Buddha in a way explaining how he reached awakening. And he says, "But it is owing to development of virtue, concentration, understanding that I have reached awakening." And so again, I think here he's showing that the spiritual path is not just in a way meditation. But there is in a way a bigger environment in which the meditation finds itself. And so in a way you have virtue, which is ethics, which is morality. Then you have concentration. And then you have wisdom. And so in a way he's telling us that when we cultivate the path, the Buddhist path, the meditative path, it's not enough just to sit. Of course sitting meditation, walking meditation is very useful. But in order to have, in a way, I would say, a more complex development spiritually, we also have to cultivate an ethical attitude, and we also have to cultivate a certain wisdom, an experiential wisdom, trying to really experience for ourselves the impermanence, the unpredictability, the conditionality. Because this is what will make a difference, actually, in terms of the compassion. That if really, if we know impermanence, actually what is interesting, what arises, is this compassion. If we really know, in a way, suffering, what arises again is compassion. So in a way, to see that the wisdom is not a dried intellectual wisdom, but very much an experiential wisdom which will allow those qualities of compassion and wisdom to be developed. And so that's these three things together help the Buddha to attain awakening. And what is interesting is that the ethics will help the meditation will help the wisdom will help the ethics. So actually the three are totally complementary. And then I wanted to share one of my favorite texts of the Pali Canon. I won't read it all, it's kind of a few pages long. But it's a Sigalavada Sutta, also known as Sigalavaka Sutta. It's a discourse to Sigala. And basically it's looked at the layperson codes of discipline. But this text is not a kind of a list of do and don'ts. Not at all. It's very much something to look, is very much the Buddha is looking at condition. What is it that is going to help your spiritual life and your ethical life? What is it that is not going to help it? And so one of the first things he says is, if the noble disciple is not led by desire, anger, ignorance, and fear, he will not commit any negative actions. So it's kind of saying, you know, one is not bad per se, but actually generally negative action, harmful action comes out of certain roots. Desire, I want for myself. Anger, I don't want, I reject, I push away. Ignorance, delusion. But to me, what is the most interesting one is fear. Is to see that actually fear can actually also be one of the roots giving rise to harmful action for ourselves and others. And then it makes us question, how am I fearful? Do I have what I would call an emotional habit of fear? And what is this causing me to do? And so in a way, to me, this is why the mindfulness of the feeling is so important. To be aware, instead of being in the story of the fear, I am afraid, and then you go into all kind of meaning, history, scenarios, to just stay with the feeling. And in a way, with the vipassana, to question the feeling. I have this feeling, which I call fear, anxiety. But what is it? Am I afraid for a good reason? This is, I think, when we're afraid, it's, am I afraid for a good reason? Because if you look, a lot of the time, we're actually afraid in the future. We're afraid because, what if this happens? And then we become very anxious. And I think in a way, the meditation could help us not to be anxious in advance. To be at peace now because nothing is happening. And then if something dangerous happens, to be afraid is not necessarily going to help us. It's a survival mechanism. But actually maybe stability and openness, creative engagement, is what will help us. Then I just wanted to read you this, one of my favorite passages of this. And here the Buddha is looking at the consequences of various things that if you do them, it's not such a good idea, because generally it will lead to unhelpful consequences. And here he talks about the six evil negative consequences in being addicted to laziness. So 2,500 years ago this existed already, and the Buddha says he or she does not work, saying, so cool, it's too hot, too late in the evening, too early in the morning, I'm too hungry, I'm too full. Doesn't this sound familiar? And then he says, living in this way, that person leaves many duties undone. New wealth is not going to be produced, and wealth that you have now is going to dwindle. And so he's not saying laziness is bad per se. The problem is the consequences of it. And basically the whole text is about, in a way, consequences. What happened if you do this? What happened if you do that? And then he talks of wealth. Because often there is this idea in the spiritual path that, you know, we must be not attached. And so generally the first idea one thinks, okay, I must get rid of all my possession and give it to my great teacher, who then will go and buy some Mercedes with it. But we won't look into that. So, here is what the Buddha says about wealth. This is very interesting. The wise and virtuous shine like a blazing fire. He who acquires his wealth in harmless ways is like a bee that gathers honey. So in a way he's saying there is no problem with wealth if it's produced in a harmless way. And he said with wealth acquired harmlessly, a lemon is going to divide his wealth in four ways. One portion, he uses it for his wants. Two portions he has to spend on his business, and one portion he keeps just in case. He needs it or somebody else needs it. But to me, this is not kind of like saying, you know, you must get rid of everything. He's saying, be careful. You know, first don't be idle, because then you will have no wealth. Then if you want to produce wealth, do it in a way which is compassionate, which is not harming yourself or others. And then you have to be careful with this wealth. It's not just for its own sake. One part you use for what, you know, you need to do for daily life. Two parts, I mean, he was like a businessman. Two parts you need for your business, for it to grow, to produce more wealth. And then one part you need, you know, to help yourself, to help others. So again, here we have somebody who to me is again very pragmatic, very practical. And then another favorite of mine here is the five ways a master should minister to his servants. Because in those days they had servants and employees. And what does the Buddha say? Again, you know, often we have this feeling in this text there will be great mystical thing. Not at all. The master must assign the employees work according to their ability. He must supply them with food and wages, He must tend to them when they ill. He must share with them any delicacies. And he must grant them holidays time to time. I mean, 2,500 years ago, this was quite, you know, special for his time, to just think in this way. That actually there is this mutual respect, mutual consideration. The employee must do things for the master, but also the master must do things for the servant. So there's again, with the Buddha, I think, again and again, this idea of conditionality. To me, this is very important, that one kind of learn, one see the condition. How can I help my conditions? How can I help others' conditions? So it's really kind of seeing the flow of inner conditions coming together with the flow of outer conditions. Then a quote which comes from the beginning. This is a Buddha, and to me it's kind of, in a way, maybe even before awakening, it's one of his breakthrough. Nothing dramatic, you know, I must tell you. But in a way, it's when the Buddha is sitting in meditation and he's having a hard time. It's not working. And it's not working because he's sitting in the forest in meditation and he's afraid. He keeps thinking this feeling of fear and dread. He sits and he tries to watch the breath and he feels very afraid. But then his breakthrough, he said, I thought, why do I dwell in constant expectation of the fear and dread? Why not dissolve that fear and dread while maintaining the posture I am in when it comes to me? And while I walked, the fear and dread came upon me, but I neither stood nor sat nor lay down until I had dissolved that fear and dread. And to me it seems it's a point when the Buddha saw that actually he was an actor in his own conditions. That he doesn't have to just submit to conditions as they arose. He had feeling of fear and dread. He did not necessarily need to feel it in such a way that he would be overwhelmed by it. And suddenly he thought, why am I believing in this? Why am I caught in this? Could not I have the same feeling? He's not saying that there is no feeling, but could I have the same feeling, but could I be not overtaken by the feeling? And to me, this is what we try to do in meditation, is that we sit in meditation, and sometimes we might have very good condition. So we feel very calm, very clear, and we have fantastic meditation. And then all the time, we sit in meditation and we're so sleepy, or we're so agitated, or we're so disturbed, or whatever it is. And the Buddha is saying, look, even with that, you can be with it. You can be with it in such a way that actually you don't identify with it. Because this is, I think, what happens to us. We just think, this feeling of dread and fear and dread is me. Until that moment he thought, this is me. And this is awful. And then he started to see, okay, this is happening to me. I don't have to define myself by it. I don't have to be overwhelmed by it. I have the feeling, but if I stay with it long enough, without being overtaken by it, it will disappear. And this is what he finds. He finds that it works. And to me, this is, I think, after that he really kind of started very diligently to practice meditation. Then there is another, this is another quote which is, I think, very interesting. And this is about, in the spiritual path, one of the questions I get asked again and again and again. Do you think I need a teacher? You know, my very own special teacher. You know, he'll just take care of me, tell me what to do, and I'll be sorted. You know, he will be awakening in the next second. And then the next question is always, you know, where can I find, you know, a good, awakened, whatever teacher? You know, you don't want any teacher, you want, you know, a good one. And personally, I think when we think about this, I think we could use this quote, where the Buddha says, Because often what we think is important is experiences. Is this teacher awakened? Has he gotten amazing experiences? But the Buddha is not saying that. He said a man's virtue, because this question was asked to him when it was very sneaky of one of the king in his time. He was with the king, and the king said, "You see this mendicant over there? What do you think of them? Do you think that they're great spiritual beings?" And the Buddha said this, and I'll read it out. And once he said this, the king said, "This is very good, because actually they're fake. They're my spies. They're not at all mendicants." Anyway, the Buddha said, a man's virtue is to be known by living with him, and then only if we attend to him or her, not a little, but over a long period, and if we neither fail in attention nor lack of understanding. So actually you need condition on both sides. If you want to really know somebody's ethical behavior, you have to live with that person for quite some time, and at the same time you yourself must be very attentive and also have some understanding. A man's fortitude is to be known in time of adversity. And again, by staying a long time with them and not a short time. And to me, this is one thing to, you know, when sometimes we see all these great teacher and we easily, this great teacher. Me, what I think? Give me that great teacher, put him in a car accident or in a kind of very difficult situation and let's see how they are. If they stay calm, fine, they are great. If not, then I have little doubts. So in a way, it's very easy to appear wonderful. You know, I am a great Buddhist teacher. You know, when everybody does everything for you and give you lots of money, I mean, you know, it's easy to be spiritual. A man's understanding is to be known by discussing with him, and then only if we attend to him, not little, but over a long period. And again, if we neither fail in attention, no lack of understanding. So again, there is the same idea that, you know, a man's understanding is not just by kind of, you know, you can have beautiful speech, really charismatic, beautiful speech. But I think, again, you have to talk with a lot with the person and then to see, I mean, does it make sense? And can I apply this? So it's not just word, but that the word really are meaningful. So, in the same that I speak to you, don't just believe what I say, but really listen to it and think, does it make sense? Can I apply it? Is it useful? If it is, please use it. If it is not, forget it, you know, just like the sound of the rain. It appears, stayed a while, and disappeared. It is not sacred. It is not the final truth on anything. Then there is this quote where the Buddha is talking to his son, who became a monk, or so the legend goes. Rahula, any kind of material form, whatever, whether past, future, present, in oneself, or external, coarse or fine, inferior or superior, far or near. So he kind of, you know, everything. That's what I like with the Buddha. He really looks at all aspects, everything. He considers everything. Any kind of material form, whatever, any shape of any kind, should all be regarded as it is actually with right understanding thus. This is not mine, this is not what I am, this is not myself. And so again, the Buddha is not saying that we should reject material form. He is not saying that we should be ascetics. But he is saying we should be careful in the way we identify ourselves with whatever it is, that it be a thought, an emotion, a sensation, material properties, studies, partner, whatever it is. It doesn't mean we cannot have a relationship with that material form, but we have to be very careful when we say, this is mine, this is what I am, this is myself. Because I think often that's what we do. We fix ourselves. I am like this. This is like that. And as soon as we do this, in a way, we kind of limit ourselves, limit the situation. And so the Buddha is saying, explore material form, the relationship you have with yourself, with other, with the world. Can you see it from the point of view, this is not me, this is not myself, this is not what I am, but it's something that I can use, this is something which is part of the condition, this is a function, and not just kind of an identity. And then he goes on more to say to Rahula, try to be like water, Rahula. When people wash away these things with water, that water is not ashamed, humiliated or disgusted. So in a way he's saying, you know, water is used to wash away dirt. But the water doesn't feel dirty by the dirt. You see, it's kind of in a way looking at coloring. How we color ourselves, how we color others. Again, how we grasp, how we identify. Try to be like fire, Rahula. When fire burns this thing, that fire is not ashamed, humiliated or disgusted. This again, this idea that I think we are very easily influenced, much more than we think. You look at a program on TV, I mean, generally, at the end of it, you're convinced. Then they kind of, you know, next, have a program which says the opposite things, and very likely you will be convinced again. It's very, I mean, we can, somebody said something about somebody. Once I had that experience, this friend said for an hour a bad thing about somebody else, who had done nothing to me. But by the end of the hour, I started to be, yes, that person is really bad. You know, so we can easily be, in a way, colored. Influence. And he said, you know, try to still to be in the condition, but actually not retaining, not grasping, not defining ourselves by the condition. Try to be like space, Rahula, for by so doing, when agreeable or disagreeable contact arise, they will not invade your heart and stay there. For space has no standing of its own. So again, he's not saying that we should not have agreeable sensation or not disagreeable sensation, but that in a way they are not permanent. They're not going to be there forever. They come, they stay a while, and they pass away. So in a way, he's trying to tell us to be more spacious. And to me, this is the aim of the meditation, that we can actually develop spaciousness within ourselves, so that when we encounter something, we can creatively engage, we can creatively respond, instead of kind of being in automatic, reacting automatically, and kind of fixing ourselves, fixing the situation. So in a way, in our life, in our daily life, trying to use this metaphor, the metaphor of water. How can I be like water? How can I be like fire? How can I be like space? And then the last two are about right speech, so to speak. And to me, this is a very important aspect of practicing meditation in daily life. It's what I would call the meditative art of listening and speaking. And of course, when we do a silent meditation day or meditation retreat, we're working on different capacity we have. But then we need to use this capacity to then apply them in our daily life where we generally speak and listen. And in a way to look at what happens when we listen to words. And that's where the Buddha says, unguarded men provoke with words like darts, and they let fly like against an elephant in battles. But when hard words are spoken to a bhikkhu or a bhikkhuni, let him or her endure them with an unruffled mind. And this is something which I find interesting about words. Words, what is a word? I mean, a word is just a little kind of, you know, I don't know all the scientific term, but like a sonorous wave. It arises and it goes. Little example. I could look at you very meaningfully. Very kindly. And I could say, you are all awakened. And you think, oh, great. Say, I am awakened. Great, great, go home. She said, I was awakened. I am awakened. Or, I look at you meaningfully, but a little more. Darling. And I say, you are all stupid. She said, I was stupid. Oh, this is terrible. Oh. 2 years later. Martin said I was stupid. But what is a word? Awaken, gone. Stupid, gone. And I think it's very important when somebody says something to us. Is it about us? Is it about them? This, I think, this is the first thing we have to choose. And we have to kind of listen. You know, what are they saying? Is that any connection with reality or not? Once I was in a meeting, one of these personal meetings you have in communities which are fairly painful. And then the guy said, you know, you organize, he suddenly turned to me and for the next 30 minutes I really got an earful. You organize us too much, you are terrible, I'm fed up with you. And da-da-da-da-da. So I was there. Being very Buddhist, not saying anything, but... But then, listening to him, I thought, yeah, he is right. I have a tendency to organize, so maybe, you know, I need to cool it. I did not like that he said it that way, but it had something, he was saying something about me, definitely. And with something which I could learn to work with, and I still work with to this day. But another time, somebody started to shout at me. You are like this, and you do this, and da-da-da. And I was kind of like... He did this for 30 minutes. I thought, very interesting. Never seen anybody do something like this. Very interesting. And it had nothing whatsoever to do with me. I had never done any of the things he said. So I just listened, because he obviously wanted to say it. And then I said, well, you know, so be it. And so in a way to see... You know, it's kind of the question when we hear word is, do we buy it or not? You know? And often we so quickly identify with it. We grasp at the word, this is me. And instead of, okay, what is this about? What can I do with this? How can I listen to this? How can I creatively engage? How can I creatively respond? Sometimes you have to remain silent. Sometimes if the feelings are not too... You can try to find a way to try to see what is going on. Once this happened to me, there was this fellow, another Buddhist, etc. We are working together and suddenly I said something. Oh! And he really did not like it. So he went into this huge field and he was really... And I said, okay. I mean, I could have, you know, shouted bigger than him, but I thought, what's the point? So but it took me 30 minutes. But 30 minutes, I managed to kind of calm him down by listening, by trying to... And in the end, it was okay. So in a way, it's kind of like sometimes you feel aggressed and then you want to kind of, you know, be bigger or whatever. But a lot of the time, it doesn't help. Sometimes it might, but very rarely. And so in a way, it's kind of having that stability, like the Buddha said, with an unruffled mind. It doesn't mean you don't respond, you don't engage, but you do it from an unruffled mind, from a calm, stable, open mind. And the last one, which I think is really essential, this to me is, in terms of right speech, is really essential. He or she does not, in full awareness, speak falsehood for his or her own hands or for another hands or for some petty worldly hand. So he's kind of already looking at, if I lie, why do I lie? Is it for my own interest? Is it for somebody else's interest? Or is it for, you know, to kind of sort, you know, make things easier for myself? So he's kind of questioning. He's not just saying, don't lie. He's saying, look, if you lie, what is the reason for that? And in the end, is it going to be helpful? But more than that, he abandons slander. And to me, this is what is important. As one who is neither a repeater elsewhere or what is earned here for the purpose of causing division from this. No, and then he, to be more complete, that's a Buddha. And no, a repeater to this or what is earned elsewhere for the purpose of causing division from those. We thus a reuniter of the divided, a promoter of friendship, enjoying concord, rejoicing in concord, delighting in concord. I think concord is important for the Buddha. He becomes a speaker of words that promote concord. And to me, this is one of the main things about right speech. Is what do we do with the word we use in terms of groups, in terms of family, in terms of friends, in terms of the working environment? Are we using words which actually will help toward a creative harmony? Or are we using words in such a way that we create dissension? And that, to me, is very painful. Because often, I have seen this again and again with groups of people, how if there is any trouble, then people take sides, and then one person tries to enlist the most people saying, you know, I have 10 behind me. Poor, you only have 2. I am right, you know. And then to use everything. And then you forget about harmony and concord. You just think about my position. I want to be the winner. And so in a way to see, it's very important when there is any groups of people, are we speaking in such a way that is going to lead to more harmony between the people? Or are we going to speak in such a way that is going to lead to dissension? And I read recently in a book some I thought it was a wonderful example. I mean, this is just between two people. And this is, you have this Zen teacher, American, kind of funky, punky teacher, who has a very clever mind. His books are really, he has such a clever mind, incredibly funny mind. And there was a wife, so he's driving, they're together in the car, and the wife says something. And he thinks of an amazingly funny rejoinder. Ah, this was such a kind of, you know, a cutting, funny back end. And he really wants to say it, because it's so funny. How can he miss it coming to light, these funny words? And he thinks, no, this is a bad idea. However funny it is, clever it is not going to lead to more harmony of the situation. And so he did not do it. And then it was much better. So I think we have to be careful, because sometimes words, we kind of get lost in the fun of the words. And actually we might create more pain. It might be fun 1 minute, but actually the pain might last much longer. So in a way, not only for ourselves and others, but to kind of see really how do I speak? How do I use speech? And to really bring it, this is back to this environment of harmlessness, of compassion to ourselves and others. It doesn't mean that we have to speak political correct speech all the time and be always worried about what we say. To me, what we need to develop is what I would call meditative awareness. What do I say? How do I say it? And what is the effect those words have on others? What do others say to me? How do they say it? And how do I feel about it? And from all this information, then creatively trying to see, oh, if I say it this way, actually it's much better. And it doesn't make that much difference. So for us to kind of investigate, that's why I think creativity really comes in. How can I say this in such a way that the person will hear it? Because this is what is important. And how can I say something in such a way that actually the difficulty between people will go down instead of going up? So, that's what I wanted to say this afternoon. And then at the end of the day, we can again have a little discussion. And so now we have some walking meditation, because I think after lunch one always needs to have a little kind of fresh air, so that the first sitting won't be so sleepy. And so For 15 minutes we walk slowly and mindfully, and then we come back here at 3 o'clock.